Division of the Colorado Court of Appeals to consider one matter on the docket today. That matter is Garcia against Medved Chevrolet. We have, as a panel, read the briefs, all of the briefs, the various briefs that have been filed in the case. As you all know, occasionally a case can come up through the motions division, and it's worthy of oral argument, as this one is. So in that regard, we've treated this as though it were a regular case to be set on the docket, and it is. So we have read the briefs. We've been into the record. We're familiar with the facts of the case. And if that helps in allowing you to streamline your presentation, so be it. You have 15 minutes per side. The yellow light will come on when 5 minutes are remaining to allow you to plan any kind of rebuttal. With that explanation, I would ask that everyone turn off cell phones or pagers so that we're not, we don't bother the lawyers who are making their arguments. And when you are ready, sir, you may begin.
May it please the court. I'm Dan Riley, and I'm along with Molly Ferrer. We represent John Medved and his dealerships in this case. And we ask this court to reverse the trial court's certification of two classes. We ask this court to do so because the trial court committed errors in law by finding that there was a presumption of two elements in the Consumer Protection Act claim. There are five elements that the plaintiffs in this case have to prove when they brought this statutory claim for consumer protection violations. And the fourth and fifth element are that they have to show that there was an actual injury for each member in the class. And then they have to show that the challenged practice actually caused that injury. This issue and those findings have been held not only in the statutory language as adopted by the Colorado General Assembly back in 1969, and which has never changed from 1969 to the present. Those elements are required. They are present. The Colorado Supreme Court in Benzing addressed those two issues. And by ignoring those two elements, and what the court at the trial level did was find that you could presume in a class setting that there was injury, and that you could presume in a class setting that the challenge practice caused the injury.
Mr. Riley, do you see a difference on the one hand between presumed reliance and therefore causation in a securities matter or a 10b-5 matter where you have a fiduciary relationship between a broker and a customer, and the question of whether you can construct a presumption of reliance in a arm's length contract negotiation between a car buyer and a car seller?
Correct. I do, Your Honor, and I think it's a critical issue here. The only way that the plaintiffs can validly certify a class here is to get a presumption. They have, in essence, conceded. They cannot prove on an individual by individual basis, on a class-wide basis, that there was an injury and that the challenge practice caused the injury. So they said to the trial court, we need you to ignore and skip elements 4 and 5 and create this presumption. That presumption is totally invalid in this case. No Colorado court has ever found that a presumption in a straight Consumer Protection Act setting would be appropriate. In the 10b-5 cases, the affiliated ute case, there are statutory reasons why disclosures would be mandated there. And 10b-5 is a congressional enactment that has requirements that finds fiduciary duties and, in fact, can impose an obligation to disclose material information. In this setting, none of those facts exist. More importantly, if the Colorado General Assembly in 1969 wanted to say, in class actions, we will relieve the plaintiffs of the obligation of finding an injury in fact for each class member, they could have done so, but they didn't. And in 1969, if the Colorado General Assembly wanted to say, in class actions, we will relieve the plaintiff of the obligation of linking the challenged practice with the injury, meaning finding causation. The General Assembly could have said so. It did not. And it did not change that law in any year that, that the legislature sat, the General Assembly sat, since 1969. It is not there. And the attempts to use the affiliated U case or 10b-5 cases are totally different than this situation. Yes, Your Honor.
When the trial court found liability and causation, it appeared to rely on a statute, statutory prohibition against false and misleading statements, which would just be established by the documents. Why was that incorrect?
Well, the documents don't establish causation at all. If you presume for the moment that the challenge practice here is simply that the information that was on the addendum sticker, that was, as a custom practice, put on the addendum sticker, saying that there are dealer add-ons, saying what they are and what the prices are. The claim here is that that information needed to be repeated on the final document, the buyer's order, right? In this particular setting, if you assume for the moment, for its purposes today, we'll assume that not putting it on the final document was a technical violation of the Consumer Protection Act. That stands in a vacuum. That hangs in the air. That doesn't mean that a consumer in any way, shape, or form was injured by the fact that that information wasn't there. It doesn't mean that in any way, shape, or form, any consumer, any member of the class had a causal link between whether that information was there or not. It is improper for a presumption to apply on injury in fact and causation when there is no link to do so. Three critical facts that distinguish this case from even the Benzing case, where our Colorado Supreme Court said we're not going to find a presumption of causation. In the Benzing case, there was information that was clearly not known to the ordinary consumer. The ordinary consumer buying uninsured motorist coverage doesn't know that the Colorado Supreme Court adopted De Herrera. It's just not part of what most people know. In this case, the products are on the vehicle. When the consumer goes in, they see the pinstriping. It is a signature for Mr. Medved's product. They see the clear bra on it. It says clear bra, but it's not that clear. It's visible. They see a bed liner in the truck. So the product is visible.
What about, excuse me for interrupting,
yes, of course,
Mr. Riley. What about the situation where the pinstriping or the clear mask are not on the vehicle?
Correct. Class number one. Right, that's what the court certified as the class number one. Both classes suffer the same fatal flaws. There is no way to presume in class number one, which Ms. Garcia technically could be a representative of because she bought the vehicle but didn't get the product, versus class number two, which has the product on it. She cannot be a class representative in class number two because she isn't typical of all the other claims there, and that's another reason the second class shouldn't have been certified. But in the setting where the product was not on the vehicle, the plaintiff would still have to show, even in an individual setting, the plaintiff would still have to show that it made a difference that it wasn't on the final document, right? That's what this case is about. Not that it wasn't on the car. Their Consumer Protection Act claim was you should have told us on the final document. And as the court in Benzing said, you still would have to establish that there was an injury in fact. The class one as certified includes people who may not have paid for the products. Right? That is not Ms. Garcia. It includes people who may have made, it would have made no difference to them that the information was on the final sales document. They would have bought the car anyway. Some people are not price driven. They come in with a certain amount of money, they want to buy the car. So even class number two has the same fundamental flaws. You cannot presume in class number one, even if the product was not on the car, that a customer paid for it. The second critical fact here that distinguishes Benzing, that makes this case even a more extreme case than Benzing, in which the court said we're not going to certify that class because the plaintiffs didn't come forward with a method for proving causation. That's the burden that the plaintiffs failed to meet here and that the trial court misapprehended. There is no process other than imposing this previously unaccepted presumption, which we suggest in this case the legislature rejected and no Colorado court has ever accepted. The second issue, though, factually, that distinguishes this from Benzing is that there is an addendum sticker on the car. Unlike the consumers in Benzing who are buying uninsured motorist coverage, there's nothing in the insurance policy. There's no reason to believe that the consumers were told by the agents about it. In this setting, there's no surprise, particularly as to Class 2, that people are buying and getting and what the price is for those dealer add-ons. It is absolutely available and open. The third critical distinction between this case and Benzing, which makes it more extreme than the Benzing case where the court said we're not going to allow that class to be certified, is that these individual transactions are separately negotiated. The price of a car is just where the dealer starts. We don't know what people paid for these vehicles without looking into every single deal file, without looking into every single transaction. A car that is listed under the manufacturer's retail price for $20,000 may have been bought for $17,000. And if that's true, those people didn't pay for the dealer add-ons. So the class, as described right now, whether it's Class 1 or Class 2, includes people who were not injured, includes people who were not deceived, includes people in which, if there was an injury, it wouldn't have made any difference to them. And that's the fundamental factual issue that the trial court, I think, missed, which is the court has to make a linkage between what's not on the final sales product and whether it affected the buyer's decision. That's what Benzing said. Did it affect the buyer's decision? If the negotiation has occurred, the observation of the car has occurred, the negotiation of the price has occurred, the last document isn't going to make any difference to the consumer. Really what happens in installment sales contracts, and that's what fundamentally we're talking about here, is the consumer wants to know how much per month. What can I afford per month? That's what the negotiations are back and forth. And that's what was going on in this particular case. The trial court's errors are really on page 8 of the order, and the court said that it was our contention that the individual negotiations would be critical to the determination of whether a deceptive trade practice occurred. That's not our position. We're presuming for the moment, for the purpose of this argument, that a deceptive trade practice did occur. We don't believe it did, but we'll assume for that. The court then presumed by that would be appropriate to conflate the element of injury and the element of causation. The court also erred on page 8 of its order, where it said, without determining what the salesperson discussed with each customer, defendants argued it's impossible to know if the CCPA was violated. That's not our argument. We're saying without looking at each file, without talking to each customer, it's impossible to know if they suffered any injury. Without looking at each file, without talking to each customer, it's impossible to know whether the challenge practice caused any injury. And if it's necessary to look at every single individual file, and it is in this case to determine the fourth and fifth elements of the Consumer Protection Act claim, then predominance swings in favor of the defendants, and the common issues will overwhelm the individual issues. Without a presumption, without a previously never accepted presumption, without something that the Colorado General Assembly never put in the statute, the plaintiffs cannot show a method to establish either injury for all the class members in either class or that the challenge practice caused such an injury. And under Benzing and under the plain language of the Colorado Consumer Protection Act, those class certifications were improper. We ask this court to reverse them and remand for dismissal of the class certifications. Thank you.
Got about 2 minutes and 20 seconds left for rebuttal, Mr. Riley.
Thank you.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Dan Friesen. I'm here on behalf of Hale Friesen, our law firm, and the plaintiff, Trina Garcia, in this case, is also the representative of the class. This, as the court knows, is a consumer protection class action in which the same standard documents were given to all the consumers, numbering approximately 10,000 transactions, in the same way. The same standard procedures were applied to all of these people, and all of them are consumers. That is, they bought cars. What defendants are suggesting is that individual questions about why they bought that car create individual questions which preclude a class action. If we think about that question, think about that argument, consumer class actions always involve a decision to purchase. If they're saying that, and I think Mr. Riley just stated, that we're presuming a deceptive trade practice occurred, and it occurred in the same standard way with the same standard documents, if they're saying that individual questions about why a consumer made a decision preclude class certification, that is tantamount to saying that you cannot have a class action for consumer deception in Colorado. And that goes too far, and I urge this panel not to adopt that extreme view and not to outlaw consumer class actions in Colorado. Indeed, the Consumer Protection Act explicitly makes reference to consumer class actions. It contemplates them. If speculation about what individual things were in a consumer's head could defeat class certification, we couldn't have class actions for consumers in Colorado. Let me address 3 points raised in the papers. First, they claim that the trial judge applied the wrong standard because of the Jackson versus Unocal case. Second, they argue that we don't have a uniform method of proving causation. And third, they argue that Ms. Garcia is not an adequate class representative. With respect to the Jackson versus Unocal and whether or not the trial court applied the correct standard, let me start there. First, the Jackson versus Unocal case said that the trial judge failed to apply a preponderance of the evidence standard in deciding whether all the elements of Rule 23 had been met. In that case, we had a pipeline that went across 66 landowners' properties and allegedly leached asbestos. There was a question about whether all 66 of the landowners had been affected by the leaching asbestos. And so the trial court needed to make a finding by a preponderance of the evidence whether or not the alleged wrongful conduct, the leaking asbestos, even applied to everybody. In contrast, here we have undisputed facts that the conduct at issue, the standard disclosure forms, were used in 10,000 transactions. In fact, with respect to Class 2, the trial judge made a finding. The other side moved for summary judgment that its disclosures were adequate and not deceptive. We counter-moved for summary judgment as well, saying they are deceptive. The trial judge looked at the disclosures and said these are deceptive practices as a matter of law, and they are standard. So clearly, by a preponderance of the evidence, the same behavior applied to the entire class.
Mr. Friesen, assuming that that is correct, that there is a prima facie violation of the Consumer Protection Act by the way the window stickers were affixed to the cars and the information they did or did not disclose, I want to ask you about how we presume an injury. And my question might be a little long, but I'll try to hone it down for you. My concern is that the trial court here said that in an action for deceit based on fraud, reliance may be proved by circumstantial evidence. And she cites Elk River against Huskin and Lurvy against Phil Long Ford in support of that proposition. Why that may well be true, while that may be true, is there not a difference between reliance being proved by circumstantial evidence and reliance being presumed as a matter of law?
There may be, Your Honor. And with respect to reliance being presumed, let me step back and make sure we understand what question the trial court is answering. The question is whether or not there is a class-wide method, a predominant method of proving causation. So a presumption of reliance because there was a material omission of fact that was standard and applied to all consumers gives rise to this presumption of reliance. Now, how conclusive that presumption is perhaps a separate question and one for the merits. But I think the court's question in to Mr. Riley earlier is that a different presumption for 10b-5 cases than for ordinary fraud cases is related? I hope I'm understanding the court's question.
No, I think you're on track here.
In 10b-5 cases, there may or may not be a presumption, but we have a much stronger case than 10b-5 cases. I call the court's attention to affiliated youth, the United States Supreme Court case in 1972, where they said that where the trustee had a duty, a fiduciary duty, to make certain disclosures about stock purchases and failed to make those disclosures, then we have a material omission, material, meaning that a reasonable person would rely on it. And the court points out that the reason we create this presumption is because it's very hard to prove what you would have done in reliance on something that didn't happen. So if you meet the material omission standard, if you've got a duty to disclose it, it's material information, you don't disclose it, then a reasonable person would rely on that. You can presume that the person relied on it. 10b-5 cases are less strong than the affiliated Ute case because the person had a fiduciary duty. They are less strong than the case we have before us now. Certainly, our case is much stronger than Benzing. In Benzing, there was no statutory duty to disclose. Here we have a declaration from the Colorado legislature saying that car dealers have the obligation to make these disclosures. It's a declaration that these are material disclosures. What does that mean, material disclosures? It means that a reasonable person would rely on them. And then we have a class of 10,000 presumably reasonable people. That combination of a material omission of fact, as they say, presumed deceptive trade practice occurred, together with a group, gives rise to this issue of a presumed reliance.
Well, let's apply this as a practical matter. What about the person who goes by the car? They see the pinstriping, and they see the clear mask, and they say to themselves, gee, I kind of like that. They sit down and they negotiate with their salesman, and they strike a bargain at a price that completely those items are for free.
Sure. Let me address that example. Let me make first a point about the examples and then address the example specifically. The examples that they posit, you know, well, what if the person knew? What if the person had all the information in their head that they needed? Well, then they wouldn't have been relying on this deceptive practice. That confirms that the person didn't rely on the deceptive practice. They had some other information. So reliance really is the same thing as causation, because the only way you can posit a hypothetical that gets you out of causation is to posit a hypothetical that doesn't have reliance, not relying on the deceptive practices. But let me deal with the specific situation. In consumer installment sales, you have to disclose in writing, clear, unambiguous language, all the terms of the transaction, the price, and what you're buying. Now, the reason for that is pretty obvious, because if you start negotiating about monthly price, then the seller tends to load lots of stuff into the monthly price and then manipulate other variables. So the legislature says it's a deceptive trade practice to not tell people line item by line item what they're getting. And in fact, Medved Chevrolet did give line items on a number of issues. Here's how much for etch, here's how much for the finance package, here's how much for the protection package, but they didn't itemize the dealer add-ons. So the consumer doesn't know if they're paying for that in the loaded price, if they're not. They don't know whether they can go down the street and negotiate for another car. They don't know whether they can say, well, I don't like $150 a month, but I don't really care much about pinstriping or clear bra. They don't know whether they can negotiate about it. They don't know whether it's in the price. As assumed in this argument, they have been deceived, and that's what the court ruled as a matter of law about that practice. Now, this distinction between reliance on a deceptive practice and causation is really illusory, and here's why. To the extent that you had somebody who relied on these deceptive practices, that is, material information, not disclosed, and the person knew that, and they thought about buying a car, well, everybody in our class then did buy a car. So what is causation in Colorado? It has to be a nexus between the practice and what the person did that was an injury. So here we argue that the same standard deception, the deceptive practice, omitting material information that was supposed to be disclosed in writing, they omit that, and then they rely on it, because material omission, you can presume reliance, especially where there's a duty to disclose, and then they buy a car. Certainly, there's a nexus between the deceptive practice and buying the car. I was trying to imagine a situation where you wouldn't have causation. Suppose somebody relied on that information and then went down the street and decided, well, you know, I'm not going to go back to MedVet. I think I'll buy this other dealership's car. Now, that would be somebody relying maybe in their negotiation with another dealer, but were not injured by MedVet. But by definition, these are consumers, people who made a decision to buy a car based on deceptive information. Now, their suggestion that those are cured by these oral representations are pure speculation. They are oral representations in the context of written declarations being required.
Are they affirmative defenses?
It's not clear whether they would be affirmative defenses or just negative the elements, in my mind. To the extent that they, but I think the court's question is important in this respect. The question, again, is predominance. And is there, apply the Benzing rule, there must be a class-wide method of showing causation. We have the same standard deceptive practice applied to 10,000 people. The U.S. Supreme Court in Affiliated Ute said you can presume reliance. The Colorado court in the Lurvy case said where you have a statute says you can't roll back odometers, you have to tell people what the odometer reading is. Well, you have a statute that requires that kind of disclosure, you can presume reliance. The Colorado Consumer Protection Act anticipates class actions. The fact that each individual consumer makes an individual decision that speculatively could be based on different things is not going to be the predominant issue. The test, again, is not, again, on the merits that we're right or wrong here. The test is whether we have a predominant way of showing causation, and we do, because they made the same standard nondisclosure, and then people relied on that. It was a deceptive practice, and they bought a car. We have enough to show a nexus. If they want to dispute that and rebut that and come up with different reasons, now they're arguing about the merits. They're not arguing about whether or not we have a predominant way of showing causation, whether or not we have predominance in the case. We do have causation because every consumer bought a car. Again, on the policy point, to the extent that you have a class action for any deceptive consumer practice, the consumer always makes a decision to buy. If you had to prove each individual consumer relied on a false advertisement, maybe they didn't see the advertisement. Maybe they knew the advertisement was false. You can always speculate on a number of reasons as to why there might not be a presumption of reliance. But if you allow that to happen, you would effectively never have predominance of questions of causation in a consumer class action. And the Colorado law contemplates consumer class actions. It makes several references in the CCPA to consumer class actions. And in fact, if you think about it, that's exactly what class actions are designed to do. They are designed to protect groups of people all injured in a small way, or arguably injured in a small way, and in the same way over and over again, so it wouldn't be worth any individual's while to bring the case. So we shouldn't be the first state to reject consumer class actions based on speculation that individual questions may be there. I do want to say a word about Jackson versus Unical before I sit down. And that is that in Jackson versus Unical, they said you have to prove predominance, the same behavior applied to the group, all 66 landowners. Here we have that predominance because they've admitted that the same standard behavior of adding to the cost of the car applied for class one, and the same standard disclosures for all of class two. Those are undisputed. Now, this argument about negotiating downward, well, maybe they negotiated that away. Well, if you start with an artificially inflated price, either because you haven't disclosed all the items or because you said there was something on the car that wasn't, and then you negotiate down, you're still started high so that you could stay high in your negotiations, and people are injured. Now, that might raise a question about damages, but it does not raise a question about predominance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Friesen. Mr. Riley?
Yes, sir.
I have a copy of the Consumer Protection Act in my hand. I've read it many times in preparation for this argument. And counsel referred to its reference of class actions. And it does talk about class actions in this particular document. The legislature acknowledged it. But there's nothing in here that says in class actions you can ignore element number 4, which requires that each individual have an injury as a result of the challenge practice. And there's nothing in here that says that you can ignore element number 5, which is that the challenge practice caused that particular injury. If the legislature wanted to do that, they could have done it. They had class actions in their mind at the time that this was drafted, and they chose not to do it. This is not the case in which this court should adopt the presumption that the plaintiffs need to show a class-wide method.
Mr. Riley, Mr. Friesen says, look, we've got causation. All of these people bought cars.
That's not the question, whether they bought the car. The question is whether they were caused injury by the challenged practice. The challenged practice is we didn't put the information about the add-ons in the last contract, the last document. That's what the plaintiffs have failed to acknowledge, and that's what the court misapprehended. There has to be a linkage between what they say was not on the last piece of paper and the decision to buy the car at the price. They cannot prove that without looking at every deal. And without looking, if they look at every single deal, then the case has predominance of individualized issues rather than common issues. I would suggest to ask that the court look to Lurvy. They cite this case as a case in which supports the presumption. The court in Lurvy said, this Colorado Court of Appeals 1975, we cannot believe that Congress or the state legislature intended by their enactments to reward a buyer who purchases with actual knowledge of the falsity of the representations. That's what's going on here. The class members include people who knew about the product, who knew what it was, how much it was going to be charged, and bought the car anyway. We ask this court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Riley, and thank you again, Mr. Friesen. Thanks to both counsel for your excellent arguments today. That concludes this one item on the docket for today. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. Thank you for coming down here today and giving us your arguments. The bailiff may announce a recess.